Thank you. There's a few things that I'd like to begin with. First of all, I'm also a public advocate, and I'm also the complaint department, and that's part of being a rabbi. Of course, my advocacy is kind of tuned in a different direction, rather straight up, sometimes not around. Though frustration abounds, I must admit, we have a lot of faith in the system. It's a different kind of bureaucracy, but it seems that it's been working for thousands of years, and we know that it'll just get better and better as we go along. Complaint department? Yeah, complaints come all the time. No question about that, but that's another part of life that all of us deal with. And I think that particularly, we speak about elders, let me just use that word in a broad sense, complaints are almost the norm. I do want to say that I as well share the kind of experiences that Jackie mentioned just now. For quite a number of years, I had the same thing with my father, Zichron Livracha. We had him in a nursing home for quite a while. Incidentally, I do work for a nursing home. Mm-hmm. I'm a rabbi in the Rego Park Nursing Home, okay. So very familiar with the system. Everything you said was right on the mark. I mean, absolutely on the mark. And one of the things that I find so sad is that I think that the general public has so little knowledge of those things that they need to know with regard to, and it's not only nursing homes, it's all the kind of care that you have to be able to become familiar with as you either become older or you become a young man like me who has parents and family members who get older and everybody suffers. And we say this always, you know, suffering is part of life, but smart people, they make sure that they do everything they can to perhaps mitigate or minimize that suffering. And knowledge has always been the single most important factor, and it's not knowing that is so painful as I observe my people, my neighborhood, my kahila, and it hurts. It really does hurt because it doesn't take all that much. One thing that you mentioned I thought was so on the mark, to come to that, what is it called, that meeting, the...
Care plan meeting.
It's astounding that I see children, sons and daughters, who love their parents with every fiber in their body and do not come to these meetings. Mm-hmm. And this meeting is perhaps the single most important thing that will determine the kind of care their parents will receive or the loved one will receive for the next period of time. And they're not there. And the reason they're not there, I think the rabbis have to take a lot of that burden. I talk of the Orthodox Jewish community. And I speak to you this evening as a rabbi. I assume, I'll tell you the truth, I don't even know what's important for me to talk about this evening, because I can give you a Torah overview, I can give you a practical overview, I could answer halachic questions that you will have, but we'll get into that. But just to emphasize, I've spoken to rabbis at so many different conventions and seminars, and asked them, why don't you do the same thing I do? And I did this for 10 years in Brooklyn. I used to devote one Shabbos a year to get up at the pulpit, instead of talking about Torah, instead of talking about Dinim, I would talk about Medicare and Medicaid. And I would talk to all those younger people about, don't be foolish and make the preparations and do what you're supposed to do. And if you think there's a mitzvah of honoring your father and mother and kibbutz avim, the mitzvah starts now. And you begin to talk to your parents about when they're young. In other words, the people in the shul are 22 years old. They think they'll live forever. Their parents, they think their parents will take care of them forever. And then I tell them, but the years will go by quickly. Somebody's going to get sick and is not going to be well, and then you're going to come scrambling and say, give me the answers, and I'm going to tell you it's too late. The estate planning should have taken care before. Nowadays, I think we're not allowed to speak about the things that we used to speak about 10, 15 years ago, how to kind of divvy up all the assets that a parent might have. So as, let me use the word just for descriptive purposes, to hide or to put away or somehow to mask all the assets, so that when the parent does have to have the help from, let's say, the bureaucracies and the government, they won't take away all the hard-earned money that they put away for the grandchildren and for the educations. And I think at the time, years ago, you used to be able actually to engage professionals that would help you do these things. If I'm not mistaken, there was a law that was passed that they're not allowed to do that overtly. I mean, there's certain restrictions. Am I right?
There are still things that you could do.
You still things you can do. In fact, you did touch upon some of them, you know, with taking out the insurances. Mm-hmm. But I think they gave us broader permission in those days to do things that actually protected the people. And because you protected the assets, you know what? A mother and a father go into a nursing home knowing that they still have certain assets, have money. Mentally, they're happier. They're prepared to live out the rest of their life, even in these bad circumstances, knowing that there is a certain amount of independence. There's still things that they can do. They have control in their money. They can give. They can share. They can provide. So this is also something that younger people don't think is that urgent. I'm telling all the younger people, there's a tremendous sense of urgency. People get strokes at 50 years old too. And young people who are 22 and 25 and 27 and getting started, had they made the preparations only to become knowledgeable and understand the system, they will minimize the grief or the suffering that they have to endure. So it's education, 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 becoming familiar. Just like, you know, the rabbi always gets up and he tells you all, make sure you learn the Chumash and the Parsha. You have to know all the, because you have to know all the Dinim. Hashem wanted, the Torah wanted us to know everything. I'm telling you, the Torah wanted us to know the rules of Medicare and Medicaid and the ins and outs of nursing homes, because that's a fact of life today. And if you love your parents and you care for your parents, you make sure. So that's the number one. And I don't know, you know, to talk about Kibbud Av Aim, that was my idea. I always say Kibbud Av Aim, it's written Lahashkoisai, Lahachiloi, Lahasoisai, Lahoitsio, all kinds of descriptions in the Gemara, how you honor your father and your mother. And one of them is to cover them. And that's an absolute mitzvah. What I say cover means cover them with all of these details. You cover yourself. You make sure everything is in order. And that's the first step in providing, because there comes a time where the pendulum swings the other way. You know, when you're young, the parents always take care of the children. Well, guess what? The pendulum swings there, and then the children have to start helping the parents. Nowadays, the pendulum swings a lot earlier than it used to. That's my opinion. It just kicks in. A lot of reasons for that. Health reasons, stress, fatigue, things that are going on. Everything has changed, as you'll see in a moment. Nothing is the same. I will just touch upon some of the ideas that I have about Kibbud Av Aim, and it'll give you an idea of what I feel is attitude. Attitude. Well, that's a big part of taking care of elderly parents. There's a tremendous popular lament today. Children, do they spend a lot of time with parents? Do children spend a lot of time with their parents? I'm a 50-year-old child. The question is, do I spend enough time with my mommy? So how much is enough time? What is enough time?
She doesn't think so.
You know, but the beauty of mom is that she won't say it. You see, that's the beauty of mom. She won't say it. But here's what I want to tell you. You know, technology has made tremendous strides. Has it helped our observance of loving and honoring our parents, or has it detracted from the observance of loving and honoring our parents? And I always say, you know what, chop the feet out of the honor thy father and thy mother, the telephone. Ah, so my sister or my aunt or everyone, oh, we call once a day, twice a day, and it's tremendous, and touch faces, and mom, are you okay, and dad, are you okay, and Saba, are you okay, and the telephone, and 2 weeks goes by, and mom hasn't seen my face. And then when she hangs up the phone, she says to herself, he loves me, but he gives me these couple of crumbs. How are you? Did you take your medicine? Every day the same thing. And was machst du? Was ist ein? Und sag mir, schicke du mir die Medizin? Und das Geld gibt und mich schelle dich gebracht zu essen ein? And everything is okay. And then, you know what? In the same 5 minutes, I love you. I never hang up the phone without I love you. And guess what? I did my mitzvah. I do it sometimes twice a day. But my mother says, I want to see your punah. Years ago, it was a little difficult. But we didn't have the access, especially when, remember, long distance rates were expensive. Who would call by phone? You wouldn't even think of picking up a phone. Do you remember those days it was expensive? You don't remember it was expensive. I remember it was expensive. You don't. I'll tell you why. No. None of you do. I learned in Israel from 1965 through 1970. We were a poor family, like many, all the European, we were poor. And I called once. In 6 years, I called home from Israel. It was very expensive overseas. Once! I wrote letters. I wrote aerograms almost every day. I called only once. You know what I called the one time? I was there for the Six-Day War. I called up to tell my mother I wasn't dead. It's a true story. It's the only time I could afford. Who could afford a telephone call? But you couldn't call in regional. Look, we went to visit. We saw. We were there. And you know what? When you couldn't go to visit, so we'd write a letter. And my bubby would tell me, I used to write a letter. In the letter, I would write her, you know, about how I remember Zaidi and how I like her dress and how beautiful it is outside. You know, we forget the beautiful texture of life. I call it the textures. It's not only the day is nice, but the day is nice because the birds are chirping and the flowers are bright and the sun is warm. Well, when I call on the phone, I don't talk to mommy about the texture of life. When I write a letter and I describe all those things and I tell my bubby how my sister is so pretty and how my brother is doing so wonderfully in school. You know what she does? She doesn't hang up the telephone. She takes the letter, she reads it, and then she reads it again. She folds it up, she puts it in her purse. And then later on the day she takes it out again. And so much joy and so much pleasure. And now I have the telephone. And my mother would tell me, and I talked to her about it, she says, I love when you come in, and I'm so happy to see you. And then she says, but you know what, do me a favor. She tells my sister, myself, she says, when you come in, your tie should be straight. And I like very much when you button your jacket. It makes me happy. I don't want to see you when you come in and your shirt is a little bit bursting out of the pants and you're not put together that well, because I know you're harried and you're in a rush and you're busy, but I like to see you. I like to see you my best. You know what that means? When I'm the rabbi in the nursing home and I see the people come to visit the parents, I say, listen, I know, pardon all, it doesn't quite smell the way you like it to smell, but it doesn't mean that you have to sit there near mama the whole time and go like this, you know, wince. And it doesn't mean that, you know, you have to ask ma, oh, you know, the charts say you're good and I see you took your medicine and thank God, and pardon me again, I don't mean to be graphic, but you understand what we're talking about, and I'm glad you had your bowel movement. And well, that's not what mama wants, and that's not what papa wants. But they want you to sit there with a smile on your face. They want you to talk about sweet things and about lovely things. They don't want to hear about their charts. They don't want to hear about their bowel movements, pardon me. They don't want to hear about all. They would like you to talk with them like you would be conversing no less than with a friend and show a little warmth, not just respect. Respect is not enough. And try to make believe you're happy to be there. It's very hard to be happy. When I would visit my father, I would walk into the nursing home and I'm a rabbi in the nursing home, but when my father's there, I'm no longer a rabbi in the nursing home. Mm-hmm. Then I'm just a little boy like all the rest of us. And I would walk in, and I'd walk over to the side, and I'd cry for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And I'd finish crying, and I'd go into the bathroom, and I would wipe my eyes, make sure, because I wouldn't want to go up. He could detect. He would see my eyes a little red. And then I would walk in, with a smile on my face, and I'd sit there and laugh, and for nothing. But not to treat him, by the way, not to talk with him like I talk to a child and condescending and patronizing, but just really to generate some honest discussion. And I talk to the older people in the nursing home, and what they've told me is more than anything else. And here's a story that I read from Rabbi Krohn. He tells of and then I'll bring it right back to what I was talking about. He says he had this woman who was having a lot of trouble, and she was speaking with her therapist, and the therapist found it strange that after many, many sessions, she never mentioned her parents. So he says to her, he says, you know, you never mention your father. And as soon as he said the word father, she began to cry. So he says, why are you crying? So she looks at him and says, you know, this years ago, when I was a little girl, I was at the Seder, and I stole the Afikoman. And I still remember that at the end of the Seder, my father walks over to me, sits down next to me, and he says, sweetheart, you stole the Afikoman, what would you like? And I looked at my father and I said, a conversation. And fast forward now, all the years later, and I talk to all these elderly people in the nursing home, and I don't mean the nursing home, in my community, in my shul, and in so many words, the thing that all of them say that they would most like is a conversation. Think the last time you had a real conversation about something that wasn't very important with a child or with a parent. A real conversation, a long conversation. They beg for a conversation and beg for communication. And we've lost that art because we're so busy and we're such a... Are we busy? Are we a busy people? I hate that word. Do you know, I hate that word with a passion. And I will tell you why. And, you know, I have to offer you some Torah too, or else I wouldn't be the rabbi. But maybe you remember this, if you remember anything in the Torah. When it talks about Kibud Avein, it says, Ish imo ve'oviv tiro'u ve'es shabsosai tishmoro ani Hashem. And the Torah placed honoring father and mother right next to the mitzvah of Shabbos. Now, why? And you know that he did that in the Ten Commandments as well. What does Shabbos have to do with honoring father and mother? Many answers are offered. Listen to what I'm going to tell you. Anybody here Shomer Shabbos? Okay. I assume so. Now, I'm Shomer Shabbos. Well, no, I work on Shabbos, actually. But my family is Shomer Shabbos. Okay. They work a whole week. I have an uncle, he's an attorney. Like I was a very busy man. We call him Mr. Busy. He's a busy man. Never works on Shabbos. How come he doesn't work on Shabbos? Because he's not busy on Shabbos, or because he doesn't work on Shabbos? He's busy. But why don't you work on Shabbos? He says, because busy is not, Shabbos is Shabbos. Busy is not an excuse for Shabbos. How come children don't visit parents? Because they're evil? How come children don't visit mommy? Because they're bad, you bad? Busy. Well, just like busy is not an answer for Shabbos, busy is not an answer for honoring father and mother. And if anybody tells me they honor the Shabbos and they don't honor their father and mother, they're fakers. Don't tell me Shabbos if you don't honor your father and mother. If you're too busy for your father and your mother, then that Shabbos has no meaning to you either. No busy. There's nothing holier in this world, in God's earth, than the relationship that we have with the father and the mother. Not just because we owe them, but because they're everything. They are everything. I still lament a story that I experienced myself with this father, my late father, whom I loved so dearly. He's himself a great rabbi. And I remember telling him once, you know, Pa, somebody asked me this week, what is the way you honor your father? Now, my father's a great Talmudist, and he was in love with the Rambam. He loved Rambam. And I said to that person, you know how I honor my father? When I come into the house, I sit and I talk with him, and I answer a Shavera Rambam. That means a heavy, difficult Rambam. When I offer a teretz for a heavy Rambam. My father says, is that so? Come with me. And he pulls me into his shul. He has a shul right near the house. I don't know what he's doing. And he brings me to his Svarim shelves, and he points to his Rambam. My father has a Rambam that he purchased in 1948. Now, Maimonides, the Rambam, is itself a big tome. This was from Feldheim Publishers, the biggest tome ever published. It's this big, this heavy. For whatever reason, they put it all together in one, and it's this high, and I guess they wanted to have that fame that they put out the heaviest, biggest tome, and that was the Rambam. My father points to it. He says, you know, the last time you were here, you took it down, you showed it to me, you opened it up, and you answered a Shavera Rambam, a heavy Rambam, a difficult one, but you didn't put it back. I had to pick it up and put it back with my hands as an old man. He says, that is a heavy Rambam. And he taught me, you know, the little things, you know, you honor your father, you honor your mother. When I come in, I would come in, you come in with a something. Come in with, not a card. Don't come in with a card. A card is an excuse. If you come in with a flower, you come in with a piece of candy, you come in with a letter, you come in with something too. Little things, tiny things. Tiny things are not just expressions of love, but it's just demonstrating that you care, that you think about, that you give time, and that's the key. It's the time and we're just so busy and we can't. And it's the brutal thing. I'll tell you, there's quite a number of things I wanted to mention about that, about our loving relationship. And you know, I have a friend in Hillcrest, and he tells me, he would sit and say, me? He's quite a bit older than me. I was so good to my father and mother, and it was hard for me. I had no car. He lived in Queens. His parents lived in the Lower East Side. Anybody here, and there's a reason I ask, anyone from the Lower East Side? Well, if you don't, then the sweetness, I guess, of this story, a bit will be lost on you. But there was a beautiful deli there called Sam's Deli, very famous, like Gus's Pickles, Crossing Delancey. No one ever saw Crossing Delancey. So you had Gus's Pickles, and you had this other store. And he said, I would go to the Lower East Side to be Mekayim Kibbutz Ava Aim, honoring my father and mother. And I'd take my father down to Sam's Deli, and I'd buy him this, every time, the same sandwich. It was a tongue sandwich, and he loved it, and I would sit with him and watch him eat it. And I would eat nothing. And I said, Dad, I just love giving it up. It just makes me happy we can spend the time. And I'm listening to him. I say, yeah, but what'd you do for your mom? And he looks at me and says, oh, my mom, I let her make me lunch. He said, so you know, you just have to know, how do we make them happy? What can we do to inspire them, to make them feel loved, to make them feel appreciated? So I'll tell you something that is very, very important. I think that this is what I would say to all the young people in my kahila. There's a big difference between me and my father, generation-wise, and my children and my generation. And I'll tell you what the difference is. I call it like the change ratio. And the change ratio means like this. The lack of wisdom that older people have is in direct proportion to their inability to adjust to the new technology. Think of that. The lack of wisdom, or let's use the word, the stupidity of older people, is their lack of ability to adjust to the new technology in the eyes of young people. That's called the change ratio. In the eyes of young people. Now, it means like this. When I grew up, and I'm 50 years old now, when I grew up, there was nothing that I can do that my father could. We both didn't have remote controls. We both didn't have to program VCRs. There was no microwave oven. And we weren't befuddled by computers. And truthfully, my father did everything better than I did anyways. There were some little gadgets, new things maybe that I was familiar with, but there was no great change. Now, the difference between my generation and my children are astounded by how dumb I can be. They don't get it, you know. I have grandchildren who are smarter than me already. They're at the computer and they have this prowess in things that I can't dream lifetimes of accomplishing. So that's the change ratio. So I'm telling you, you know, and we joke about it, right? No, wrong. They do think they're smarter. I never thought I was smarter than my father. There were some things I can do. This generation really, and maybe, you know what? Guess what? They might be. Because technology has increased that scope of education, the ability to know more. This is real. They're smarter. There's a tragedy in that. You know why? Because it's only the wise child that knows how to walk in and sit in front of his parents and still let them know that he believes that they are smarter. It's very painful. Very painful for elderly people to feel that these younger people who haven't the experience in life and didn't have to endure everything that we endured. And in Yiddish, it's the halt to bist agroise chochen. Agroise chochen. You know what, really, you're not a big chochen. So there are things that you might be able to do and might know. That doesn't make you smarter. And that doesn't make me, pardon me, the word stupid. And there's a tendency on the part of young people inadvertently to make elderly people feel feeble and not smart and incapable. They don't mean to do it, but they just do it because of their impatience. And as a word you used before, language, language, language. They talk a different language. There's a high-tech language today. It's like, you know, I speak Yiddish. Not everybody speaks Yiddish, but I still remember my aunt saying that I had a cousin. That cousin's brilliant. Why? Because he can drive in a car. You know, there's things that are different, you know. They know the new language and they speak the new language. And you know what? My kids look at me and they say, wait a minute. But does he surf? Does he rollerblade? Does he? I mean, we don't do these things. So you know, this is, we are feebler. Good child, the one who is cognizant of what I'm talking about, he lets the parents know that they are smarter. You go into old parents in a nursing home, and you sit and talk with them, those conversations I told you about, you let them know, you know, Dad, even when you're gone, I will still give to those charities that you gave to, because you're so, that's the best. I want you to know that I'm getting involved. You know what that does for a parent? Son says, you gonna do that, son? And he says, yeah. Tell me what he feels like. What do you think the parent feels like? He believes that my life had value. I did the right things. What I taught him is important. He cherishes what I cherish. You let them know that you cherish what they cherish. The father doesn't always want to hear about your victories and your successes. There's a certain measure of nachas we have from children when they reach certain points in life and achievements. But that doesn't make mom and pa happy just because I'm making money. And just because I'm successful, and believe it or not, it's not enough for mother and father just to know that I'm happy. They actually have to be happy too. And I think that this gets lost. These are simple things I'm telling you, but they get lost in the shuffle. And the reason they get lost in the shuffle, because we don't talk about it enough. We don't talk about it frequently enough. We're almost afraid to talk about it. I didn't get into yet the disrespectful aspect of relationships. You know, kids leave home so early today, and there's a lot of dislike, hatred even, between parents and children today, much more than ever before. Much more than ever before. You know why? Children leave home, you know, that at an earlier age, they get married at an earlier age than ever before, but children leave home, let's take in the Orthodox Jewish community. Now they all go to Israel at, 17 and a half, they're all in Israel. Girls, they come back, and then they want to get married right away. Boys, once at 17 and a half, they're in a dormitory, they don't come back home. You know, they're out of the house. Because children are out of the house so early today, they never had the opportunity to work out all the issues that they have with parents. Because I'm telling you right now, there are issues. And a lot of parents like to make believe that there are no issues at home. It has nothing to do, you know, we love mother, father, everybody's okay. I'm not saying there's chaos at home, but there are issues. There are girls who have issues with their mothers and boys who have issues with their fathers, and real issues, and things that hurt terribly. But it used to be years ago when they stayed home or in the same area, just by virtue of the fact they were closer together, there was time to work out. These issues got worked out over time. Not anymore. The issues stay for a lifetime, and they surface later on. They manifest later on. It's a very painful part of what's become the norm for an Orthodox Jewish community. People are afraid to talk about it. First of all, nobody wants to admit they don't get along with their children, and everybody likes to pretend that, you know, our family's the most beautiful and everything is rolling along perfectly. Well, it doesn't. And unfortunately, you know, we're not trained and we don't talk about it enough and we ignore these things. These are some of the issues we can talk about. I think, you know, maybe I ought to take questions instead, because I can go on and on. I have so many different things about Kibbutz Avein to talk about. Somebody wrote me a letter, and I thought that this letter was very good, because a sample of questions, dear Rabbi Faskowitz, and she has a group of people, this woman who's struggling with the issues that we spoke about, parents who need elder care. Here are some of the dilemmas and the questions that we want to bring to you. What does one do halachically? They're asking me according to Torah law, so, you know, I'm decisor, I have to give a decision. They're afraid to make their own decisions. What does one do when parents make the wrong choices? Parent says, hey, you know what, I still sign the checks. I'm not feeble-minded, and this is my choice. And you know your mother made the wrong choice. You know your father made the wrong choice in regard to health care. If and when do you take over? When do you become When do you become strident? When do you become tough with your parents? Because we're not allowed to be tough with our parents. No one, I hope, raises a voice to a mother or a father. You're never allowed to raise a voice to father and a mother. You know, there's one thing that I just mentioned to you, we'll get halachic too. You know, there's a question in the Gemara, how far is honoring father and mother? So you know, where does it go to? So there's a story in the Talmud where you had Dama ben Messina was his name, and he was a rather famous person, and he sat in the Senate in Rome. And his mother came over one day and began to bang him on the head, tore at his clothes, and spit in his face, says the Gemara. And he did nothing. And he just said, okay, Mom, all right, it's okay. And she walked away. So here the Gemara explained, this is how far one must endure, never shame a mother, never raise a voice. So the question that I would ask all of you is, what was this woman? What was she? And here I'm going to ask, was she a bad mother? Does that mean if a mother is evil, an evil mother, a bad mother? There are such things, rare, thank God. But if one has to suffer, does he honor that woman? What was the case? Or was she perhaps out of her mind? Well, there are two opinions that are in the commentary. And it makes no difference whether it's a bad mother, whether she was not well, it doesn't matter. We have to honor father and mother. You never raise your voice. You never humiliate. And so what do I do when mother's irrational? What? And I'm not talking Tourette syndrome. You know, that's a different issue. I've had that question too. How does a child deal with that at home when he has to kind of mediate between father and mother? But on a smaller level, when the parent is making a mistake, when do you take over? When do you take the checkbook? You never tell a parent, by the way, I pay the bills. That's the worst and most hurtful thing you could ever say to a parent. I pay the bills. Don't ever say that. It's a very bad thing. But when do you take over? That's a question we have to see. This involves seeing which physicians. Sometimes they want to go to one physician. You know the physician is no good. Can you impose? Do you then go to those people who might be able to help? Do you have a rabbi intervene? Do you have family put pressure? These are searing questions. Home care. When do you insist that someone come into the house? When the mother says, I can take care of myself. Ma, you can't take care of yourself. Or dad says, I can do it alone. You can't, and I walk into the house. I can't walk in here. Well, can you cross him? Can you force the issue? And sometimes forcing the issue, you have to go to bureaucracies, you have to go to the authorities, and you know, this puts you in it's a terrible dilemma. And these are questions that are asked. And then when you get to the denial, you get to the, what does a child do when they hear statements by parents who are suffering, they deny their belief in God, they don't want to go to shul anymore, you know, religious questions of this nature. I thought this one was one that really deserved a lot of talk. How does one deal with siblings who take the easy way out and let one handle the problems and responsibilities of aging parents? What would the rabbi recommend? So it happens to be my recommendation is you act very candidly with lots of guilt. You throw guilt at your siblings like it was going out of style. But most important, you keep a written record and a log of every single thing you do. When the other brothers and sisters don't respond and you're the one or two of them, one, you keep a log of every single thing you do. Because I will tell you this, because 5 years down the pipe, they're going to swear that they took care of mom and dad and you did nothing. And that's going to really tear everything apart. And that's going to confuse the whole family. And that's going to make everybody forget your devotion and your dedication. And that in itself is a dishonor to a father and a mother. These are real life and death problems. These are issues that break families apart and tear everyone apart. How does one deal with guilt? So again, I forget which one of you mentioned. That day that you had to put mom in the nursing home, mm-hmm. Did you cry?
It was one of the worst days of my life.
That's right. I would say also, I empathize. Mm-hmm. I think that day may have been, one of the worst. And it took me a long, long time to reconcile. And knowing, even though I knew from the moment I did it, I knew it was the right thing. You know what I needed then that I didn't have, though? I needed a rabbi. Mm-hmm. rabbi needs a rabbi too. So sometimes, I don't know if it's a sinful pride that didn't allow me to go seek another rabbi, or just maybe I wasn't smart enough, but that's what I needed. And I think a lot of you, when we talk about resources, one of the things you're neglecting is, and rabbis are busy, but you know what, be a pest. Be a pest, go to the rabbi. Because rabbis are pretty good at this. The only thing is they will only respond to those people that really are after them. You get inundated by so many issues that people have in their lives, but what could be more important than an issue of this nature? And I do believe it, having gone through it, I will admit to all of you, had I not been there, I would not know this. But this is real, this is real. And it affects everyone in the family. And then the hardest question of all, I think the hardest question of all is, I have to deal with aging parents, and I have children whom I love dearly, and the children cannot deal with mom or dad. And the condition that they have, maybe it's not an Alzheimer, but it's a kind of dementia where they become cantankerous, they become hostile, they become tempestuous, and especially if they're younger children, that you can't explain that. And then your wife looks at you and says, listen, you know, I've been a good daughter-in-law all these years, but what are we going to do? Do we sacrifice the children to do this for your dad, whom I love dearly? So I say, yes, you do sacrifice the children, but not in every case. More often than not, I will say, I allow the children. You know, this is part of growing up, too. There's a side of, and you work with them, and there is pain, and there is a price to pay. But in the long run, I always believe in the long run that you will not lose by having honored a father and a mother. In the long run, you gain. You may not always see it, and there's a price to pay right now. But I ask you, you know, I just say it, As a general rule, obviously each case has to be looked at individually. Is this an easy answer to present to a family? And she sits there. I had another question that I marked down that I was unable to answer, and I actually sent it to the chief rabbi of Israel. I sent Rabbi Lau a letter asking him to help me with this decision. And it was as follows. There was a woman who needed dialysis, and an elderly woman, and in order for her to get the treatment, her daughter would have to quit her job and take care of mom. And she went to her husband saying, I'm prepared to do it. And what it means is that we will tighten the belt a bit, we'll make a living. And it was clear, the question, the way it was brought to me, was that they'll make a living, the husband makes a fine living, but obviously now without her portion of that provision, that sustenance, it's going to hurt them, it's going to be a pinch. And besides that, the husband was very concerned that if she gets wrapped up into mom, you know, this will have an effect on her. And I will tell you, she did in the end, and it did. It had a devastating effect on her. But let me tell you what I did. So the husband was against this, and he said that I forbid you, according to Jewish law, I'm the husband, and I have the right to say to you that you must remain, it's called, within the confines of home. Your attentions are not allowed to be focused elsewhere. That's the parameter of the law, as it's written in the Torah. The focus of a woman has to be in her home. That's the marriage contract. So by virtue of what you're doing, you take the focus away from home, and you technically, it was a technical question, like you say before, the legalities, and I won't go into the intricacies. So, you know what, in the end, he was wrong, and the woman has rights, and she was able to tend to her mother. Mother eventually passed away. She did endure for a long time with a much greater quality of life, but it broke this poor woman to pieces, and she never recovered. Tending to her mother for the extra 2 years just broke her to pieces. It broke her spirit. Until today, it's a few years later, she just never recovered. She's not the same woman that she was. And that's what the husband at the time said he was afraid of. He says, the money didn't mean anything to me. But is a mother in a home with children, and where do you make the sacrifice? Well, you know who needs to give you that answer? That's from up on high. I would never take it on these shoulders. The only time, I'll conclude with this, and you know, again, I see where we're going, and there's hundreds and hundreds of illustrations, and I would rather take some questions, if you like. But let me just conclude with one story, because we talk about the issue of honoring parents and a mother and a father, and there's always that woman's issue that comes in there too. You know, who gets more honor, the father or the mother? I had the dubious honor of being involved in a landmark case that set precedent for the United States of America with regard to women's rights vis-a-vis their children. None of you know that. You don't even know what it means. Father and mother, and I have a baby. Baby, let's say 5 years old. And they discover a glioma in the brain. They can't do anything for it. After a while, it gets so bad that there's only two options. Either you operate and you install a shunt in the brain and remove some of the fluid and you allow the child to, and the child will live a bit longer, or you let the child expire. Those are the two alternatives you have. It's a fatal disease. What happens if the father says he wants to operate and extend the life of the child, and the mother says, my baby suffered enough, let him go? According to the Torah, according to Jewish law, who has the right? The father has the right, or the mother has the right? Who is the boss? Now tell me if that's not a contemporary question. No. The doctors said there is no right thing to do. They made it very clear.
Yeah, but the halacha, what's the right thing to do?
Then you're right. Brings a good point. You bring a good point, but just to clarify, we reached that point where even according to halacha, you know, you can look at it two ways. What do you do? So I will tell you this, and today I say it with pride, I took on the establishment. The establishment said, and it was Rabbi Soloveitchik's psak, that the father has the right to decide. Because the father is the Baal HaBayis. And I said, no, I didn't believe that. And I said that when it comes to biological decisions for the child, you want to tell me which yeshiva to go to, the father will tell me which yeshiva to go to. You want to tell me which kind of kosher to eat, I believe the father should decide. If you want to tell me which Gemara he should learn, I think the father should decide too. But anything that is a decision of biological welfare of a child, that belongs to the mother. The mother that bore that child, the mother that nursed that child, the mother that carried that child in the womb. The mother has a certain bond with a child that a father can never, ever, ever understand. And I cited a lot of sources to that, but I felt very strongly about it. What happened was, I won't tell you the whole story because I just don't want to, it'd take too long. But in the end, the courts ruled in favor of the mother, and they let the child die. Yeah, actually let the child expire. There's a magazine called Lilith Magazine. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And it's, their agenda is promoting women's issue and feminism within the Jewish community. And I'm not one of those with that agenda. Anybody who knows me knows that perhaps I'm even a little bit on the other side. But in this issue, I just felt very strongly. And they supported my position very strongly. So the New York Times wrote a wonderful article. The Los Angeles Times picked it up. And we had it cross-country. And in the end, the courts ruled in favor of the woman, and it's the mother's right to decide, and it remains the law of the land today. But it's the mother's right to decide all biological decisions, not the father's right. Now, just having brought that to your attention, I say it because of this. And it's another thing you must understand. I wish there were a lot of younger people here. You know, sometimes you say, why are the people who should be hearing this, why are they not here? You know, don't think that your relationship with your father is the same as the relationship with your mother. Doesn't mean you have to love one more or one less. Just know this, it's a different kind of relationship. And I'll leave you with two little anecdotes to illustrate that. In Igros Moshe, and that's the collection of responsa from Rav Moshe Feinstein, his son, who today is the revered Rosh Hashiva of Reuven Feinstein, at the time turned 20 years old. And in Halacha, when you turn 20 years old, there's Bar Mitzvah, and then there's the next level, is 20 years old, is tremendous responsibility. And he writes to his father, he says, you're the leader of this generation, and you're my father. I turn 20 now. Tell me, what should I know the day I turn 20? And I read this such eagerness, because I want to know, what does the greatest man in the generation tell his son when he turns 20? So he says three things. Number one, you should always study Torah. No surprise there. Number two, you should never get angry. Number three, work hard at honoring your mother. Those are the three most important things in life. And he writes, because your father you'll always honor, the mother gets somehow lost in the shuffle. You love her, but you don't honor her. You have to honor a mother. And that takes talent, he writes. That takes talent, that takes effort, that takes study, that takes desire. It's not the same as a father. And then my friend writes that here he is in Seattle, and his mom says, okay, I finally agree, I'm going to move east with you because I can't take care of myself anymore. So he flies from Baltimore to Seattle, and everything is in boxes, and there's the truck downstairs, and then there's the last 12 boxes that they're putting in the car, and they were going to drive cross country. And he says, Ma, don't schlep those boxes, because I'm going to schlep the boxes. I don't want you to schlep the boxes. And he takes it out, he schleps the box, and then the mother comes schlepping the box. She says, Ma, what are you schlepping the box? And she says, okay, I won't schlep the box. He turns around, and then she turns around again, she's schlepping the box. He says, Ma, don't schlep the box. And he sees there's this man, he's the maintenance man, is standing there, and he's looking at him in a whimsical way. He looks at Rabbi Friend, and he says, mothers. And Rabbi Friend looks at him, and he says to this maintenance man, he says, yeah, mothers. He says, they're all the same. And then the maintenance man looks at him, he says, yeah, but remember, you're lucky you have one. They're special. Mothers are special. Fathers are special. You have to learn how to treat them. You have to study. You have to put in effort. Nothing without effort. Nothing is easy. Nothing comes easy. But if you care enough and you understand the urgency and the necessity, you'll make all the effort you need to be a prince or a princess, to be the one that does what is maybe the most beautiful of all our mitzvahs, to do it in all its glory. And I thank all of you for giving me the opportunity to speak this evening.
Permit me, Rabbi, just a short comment since you spoke about mothers. I came to America after the war, and we had serious decisions to make where to run away or not. And my mother, there's a certain that mothers had feelings. I should have been the other way, but the judgment was the right judgment, and so some of us survived. Having said it, I'd like to ask a question very respectfully. Since you did speak about the schools, the yeshivas, and what caught me the strongest way is when you spoke about relationship. By the way, this is the most interesting evening I've lived in for 35 years, and it's very important. I'm going to recommend that you should have it there also.
Oh, that's a nice compliment.
Thank you. We're a good team.
But what I want to say is the relationship. Yeah. And I have a son living in T-Mac, and they have a program where they went some of the kids to nursing homes in various areas, and I went along once, and I saw how important it is. Some of them would speak. I spoke to them Hungarian or Yiddish, and it was worth everything. Isn't it right the schools, basically about yeshiva as well, other schools, should be a subject in the school, specifically in the yeshiva, relationship with parents, with grandparents.
I want to tell you something.
And I say respectfully.
Let me tell you how much I personally appreciate what you just said. And you'll know I'm not patronizing you. I started a yeshiva 3 years ago after my father passed away. And that's the yeshiva that you mentioned before, Madregas Odom, for college boys who come back from Israel. I have a curriculum that no yeshiva ever offered before. And the curriculum, part of my curriculum is, for example, fiscal responsibility. That's one. You know, in the Gemara, we learn, you got to know about mortgages, you got to know about lending, you got to know about money, you got to know what a dollar is. You know, things in yeshiva they don't talk about. Part of it is communication. Talking to girls and talking to women and talking to elderly and talking to people of other races and other colors, talking to people who are disadvantaged and disabled, and communicating. We have 15-part seminars on this alone. In other words, set aside the time from only the Gemara and only the Mishnah and learn all these things we talk about. Please God, that's my dream. That's my dream. I think the whole curriculum, and we were blessed that since the Holocaust, we've put together a marvelous educational system, but it's time for change, for big change, and we have to have new innovations in the curriculum, and exactly what you said has to become not just a class, or not just a minor part of the curriculum, has to become a major part of the curriculum, knowing how to communicate and how to be able to incorporate your lives with the lives of all the people around you too. Not to pretend, even though I am from the ultra-Orthodox Jenner, there's no question about it, but unless you can bring your life into the lives of others and the lives of others into yours, you're fooling yourself, because there is no insular society anymore. You know, it's not only global, it's everybody. So this is the answer. What you asked is the answer. You know what the problem is? The schools are afraid of major change. And I've spoken to them about doing this. You know, the issue, any of you who are familiar with the yeshiva system, the biggest criticism I get is, how do I have the right to incorporate into curriculum a whole this idea of speaking to girls, even using the word girls, you know, the ultra-Orthodox women, dating, talking about dating techniques, stuff that is supposedly taboo. You're not really supposed to talk about it to boys that are young. Well, that's crazy. Today, you need that change. They go to college together, they're in the street together. You have to be able to prepare the people for all contingencies. Well, elderly parents and respect for elders and interacting with everybody in the community is a major part of the refuah that we have to introduce.
I've heard, I don't know if it's true, that Rabbi Yisrael, Rabbi Mutterman, had every yeshiva bacher read the book by Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends.
It's a good, I'll tell you this, it's a good school.
I'm sorry?
It's a good school in there, Yisrael, and their boys are a lot more versatile than boys from other yeshivas, and it might be because of exactly what you're saying.
They're acting with other people.
Yeah.
Which is, a lot of yeshiva boys have the slightest.
Correct. They have the communicative skills are just not there, and it's a shame because they're missing so much. Any other questions? We're okay? Anybody had another question?
I was just going to say that one of the things that a lot of the day schools are doing now, I know for my grandchildren, is a lot of the day schools are encouraging nursing home visits. And I think it's really, and a lot of nursing homes are encouraging visits. And when we tell people, when we recommend nursing homes, we tell people one of the things to look for is if they do have intergenerational programs. I'll never forget, my children went to SAR in Riverdale when they were little. The third grade class went to a nursing home, and one of the girls in the class came home and said to her father, it was tragic, she said to her father, it was the first time that I knew old people knew how to smile. I mean, it was just so sad.
That's right.
And this is, and more and more yeshivas are doing this today, and I think it's wonderful. I mean, I think it's really, really important.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for a wonderful, informative Vedic evening. Thank you for the presenters, and thank you all. I hope you take some of these lessons with you.
Thank you. Good evening. It was good to be part of the team. I think we did some good tonight.
Huh? I think you made